This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.
The police department should have the sole discretion on how to spend the money as it sees fit. Reasons for funding the police department include...
At Cincinnati City Council's public budget meeting Thursday night, a chaotic scene followed one commenter's remarks in support of the police department's funding among a crowd of hundreds demanding those funds be directed elsewhere. It brought the meeting to a halt.
This hearing is over.
When you get your feelings hurt and at a job where you're supposed to be doing your duty and say this is over, you know, it doesn't matter if there are other members in there who are willing to listen. You've disrespected us at that point and you've disrespected our time.
Resist!
And another night of protest in the streets followed after Councilman David Mann stopped that meeting. We start the weekly news review with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Brianna Rice. She joins us on the phone. Brianna, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you back. Thanks for taking the time. That was quite a scene last night. We heard City Councilman David Mann gavel that public meeting as being over after the chaos that followed that one commenter's remarks that the police department should be fully funded. Can you describe what was happening there?
Yes. So I was not present until after Mann left, actually. So we were watching Sherry Coolidge from the Inquirer. Our city council reporter was actually watching a live feed, which was cut off. And that's when I was called in because they were not streaming the council meeting any longer. So we needed someone on the scene. So I got there. And when I got there, police had already blocked off the doors outside of the Duke Energy Center. So I only got in because I had my press badge. And once I got upstairs, protesters were blocking the conference room as well, but they did let me inside. And once we got there, at that point, only Councilman Lanzman was there, P.G. Sittenfeld, Councilman Lemon Kearney, and Jeff Pastor also was there. Betsy Centerman had also left once Councilman Mann left. And people were complaining for a lot of the time, airing all of their grievances. A lot of people obviously were talking about defunding the police, some about education or gentrification. There were a lot of issues being discussed before finally, when people said they felt like they weren't being heard enough, everyone decided to exit the Duke Energy Center, and they were all holding hands linked up and kind of began to occupy Elm Street in front of the Duke Energy Center between 5th and 6th Street.
And that's because this was a meeting that took place at the Duke Energy Center. The city council, which is holding a few budget hearings to get perspective from the public, are supposed to be socially distanced. So they're trying to accommodate a large crowd in a large space. So that's why the meetings were moved to the Duke Energy Center. I understand that Councilwoman Jan-Michelle Lemon-Kearney, who is a newer member of council, restarted this meeting in an unofficial capacity. But this was happening, I guess, at the same time that some of these protests had moved out to the streets. Is that right?
Yes. So I think what happened were there were protesters trying to get inside. And once they stopped streaming the council meeting, people were gathering outside because they had assumed that they'd be able to get inside. And then everyone who was already in the meeting was inside. And Lemon Kearney did take over the meeting, and she was letting different people speak. So there were three microphones set up again for social distancing measures, and people were lined up. Just airing and speaking, and council members weren't really responding to anything. It was kind of just listening, and people were taking turns. But yeah, there were protesters inside, and when I showed up outside, there had to have been more than 40 people already kind of marching around trying to figure out how they could get inside or what their plan was.
I want to read a comment from Councilman Mann as reported by WVXU's Jay Hanselman. He said, Mann told WVXU that he reminded the crowd they were there to listen to each other, and that included the man who spoke up about fully funding the police. Mann said, quote, and the crowd erupted at me, and I vividly recall a gentleman saying, we don't want to hear from somebody that we don't agree with. This is according to David Mann, who went on to say, this is on the heels of a lot of very unpleasant allegations, and I just felt like we were past the point of having a meaningful discussion or public input. It was turning into a mob. So I said, this meeting is adjourned. Let's talk a little bit about what happened outside. Our Josh Elstro, the technical director here, gathered some sound during the protests in the street. Let's hear a little bit.
We try to, like, contain it because, you know, we're all fighting for the same thing, but there are a lot of individual voices involved. And, you know, so we were trying to stay on the same page. And after we realized that they weren't listening to us, we had tried to calm everyone down. And we were trying to get back to the hearing, and they still were disinterested. He was still trying to leave. So we decided to take it out here because this is apparently the only place that they will listen to us.
And I would like to take this opportunity to invite the Cincinnati Police Department to leave our autonomous zone.
And that might have been a little difficult to make out, but someone with a bullhorn there was talking about an autonomous zone, and autonomous zones have been in the news because of Seattle and the situation that has developed there with a high-profile autonomous zone. Did we see much in the outside that meeting as it relates to creating something that we've seen in Seattle, Brianna?
Police did stay back. I did not see any police officers enter this occupation or autonomous zone at all. There were some on the side of the Duke Energy Center, but they were so far back, if you didn't actually leave the barriers and walkway, like, you couldn't see them at all. So I do think people felt as though it was an autonomous zone. There were definitely people, you know, spraying graffiti and leaving messages like say their names and a message to David Mann that said, "What are we?" So there were lots of big block white letters that said defund police across the street, which I know that 3CDC has some people out today already kind of cleaning some of that up. But it felt like an autonomous zone in that way. A lot of the organizers were not allowing alcohol inside and kind of policing themselves. There were definitely people who were yelling at photographers or people with big cameras saying you're not allowed to take photos, but I didn't see any officers or anything inside. It's really loud music as well. I mean, there's dancing and people speaking every 20 minutes or so, giving speeches about Juneteenth, what was going on, budget meetings, how to get involved, gentrification, all kinds of things. So.
And obviously, this unrest that took place last night on Thursday night follows weeks of nationwide protest against deadly police violence. We're talking about the deaths of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Breonna Taylor in Louisville, and so many other instances elsewhere that have motivated these scenes and prompted calls to defund the police and to address policing communities in a different manner. And it just so happens that here in our community that these cries for a new way of policing a community and funding police is happening during budget season. And there's a new budget that has to be adopted by the end of this month. The new fiscal year starts on July 1. We're talking with Brianna Rice of the Cincinnati Enquirer, who covered this story along with her colleagues at the Enquirer, Sherry Coolidge and Bob Strickley. Brianna, what did we hear from members of council after this? Did we hear anyone speak in favor of the position that their colleague David Mann took, or in support of the protesters that remained vigilant in their positions?
So, yeah, I saw that Jeff Pastor made a Twitter thread about it. He did speak in support of David Mann. So, sorry, I'm trying to remember exactly what he said, but the Councilmember Mann is a deliberate lawmaker and takes seriously his role as a decision maker. Although I disagree with his decision to end the meeting abruptly, there's no way he should have been treated as poorly as he was yesterday. Other than that, I have not seen any public statements from anyone else. Besides, Lemon Kearney did say that there is another meeting on Monday at 1 p.m. and that she wants to continue to hear from people. Other than that, the council members were supposed to walk out with protesters, but again, protesters abruptly left. They didn't want to be inside the meeting anymore, so it took the council members to little bit longer to kind of walk out, but Landsman came out, Lemon Kearney came out, and I heard that P.G. Sentenfeld came out as well, though I did not see him. So I know that they kind of joined in and talked to people in the crowd and got to try to listen to them, but after everyone exited the Duke Energy Center, I don't think anyone was trying to give them a platform to speak anymore.
And Brianna, you referenced Councilman Jeff Pastor and his tweet thread that came out about 4 hours ago. I'll read the last tweet of that thread to our listeners. He said, quote, "I am fed up with a few self-proclaimed progressive, rude, loud, white women trying to lecture a black man, me, about black issues. Blacks with differing opinions are still black. My voice matters. Black folk are not a monolithic group, in case you forgot." So some strong words from Councilman Pastor there. Brianna, you also referenced a meeting on Monday at 1 p.m. What are the details on that? Is that also scheduled for the Duke Energy Center? Do we know yet?
So I don't think we know yet where to schedule. I've heard it was not supposed to be open to the public, but McCurney tweeted that she wants to hear from people, so maybe it will be. I don't think we know yet.
Okay, and again, this is a situation where City Council is considering its budget. The police department is fully funded in the currently proposed budget, and then council will begin debate on that. And aside from that 1 p.m. meeting, do we know anything else that is expected to happen next? Are there protests planned over the weekend? I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot, of course, Brianna. I don't know if you have the full schedule, but if you know any details from the work that you put in last night.
Oh, no, so that's okay. I did hear about a protest that was happening today at 1 p.m. in Lincoln Heights, where people, I think the address was 27-something Road. I tweet it, so if anyone wants to look out for it. We also have...
We might have lost Brianna there, and apologize for that. We'll try to reconnect with her another time. I'm not sure if we just lost a connection. But that was Brianna Rice. Oh, there she is. Okay. Brianna, I apologize. You broke out for a minute.
I broke out? Okay.
I'm sure it's okay. We're having to do this on phones, and sometimes it's a challenge since we have to do our shows socially distanced. But we still appreciate you coming on. And in our last 30 seconds, you were talking about something scheduled in Lincoln Heights and possibly something elsewhere?
Oh, yes. Okay. So in Lincoln Heights, there was a protest scheduled today for 1 p.m. that I heard about last night from protesters. I didn't see any organized, like, Facebook posts or anything, but people were saying they were going there to protest gun ranges and just gun violence at 1 p.m. down 1027-something Road. I'm looking right now, sorry. But other than that, today is Juneteenth, of course, so... at 2 p.m. we'll have the Black Lives Matter unveiling of the new mural in front of City Hall, and I know that people are planning to demonstrate there. Loveland is having a protest today at 6 p.m. on the Loveland-Miamiville Road on the corner of Branchville Hill and Guinea Pike. So, and on Sunday, there's a reoccurring Washington Park protest at 1 p.m. that's supposed to be happening every week.
Brianna Rice.
So those are the ones planned for the weekend.
Brianna Rice is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Brianna, thank you so much for your time and the information you shared with us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Black Lives Matter demonstrations have spread from large cities to small towns, and 2 days of them took place in Bethel, where they turned heated and tense.
I've walked out here today and literally have been followed around by people that are so ignorant, walking around following me with guns, have to be surrounded by cops because it's too dangerous to be out here to speak up about somebody's life. Somebody's life is so unimportant to some people.
And that was Alina Barger, a Bethel resident. In that small village on Sunday and Monday, there was division even among neighbors. This is Joe Anter.
We're not letting any outsiders influence us, and we just want to make sure that we're heard too. It's a shame that we have so much division in this country right now. And, you know, I feel threatened. This whole town feels threatened.
Bethel Police Chief Steve Teague said that his six-officer department was stretched to the limits.
Unfortunately, this matter is nationwide, as everyone knows here, and it's put a divide in this country that doesn't need to be here.
And we thank WKRC-TV for the use of that sound from Bethel. And joining us now is WKRC Local 12 reporter Brad Underwood. He's on the phone. Brad, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me today.
It's our pleasure. And we also have from the Claremont Sun, Megan Alley, a reporter there. She's on the phone, too. Megan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on your show, Michael.
Our pleasure. We're looking forward to this discussion about what happened on Sunday and Monday in Bethel and what's been happening since and what might happen next. Megan, I do want to start with you because I've seen some social media posts today from your neck of the woods in Claremont County where it looks like there are precautions being taken in anticipation of possibly further demonstrations. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I've received word from the village administrator that the mayor had enacted another curfew. So coming out of this Sunday's events, the mayor had enacted a curfew, I believe, on Monday evening and into Tuesday. But the mayor has also taken some additional safety precautions and enacted another curfew.
And Brad, our reporter from WKRC-TV, you were there on one of these 2 days where these protests and these counter-protests were taking place. I was glued to social media watching any videos that I could find while reporters were there and people on the scene were sending out any types of images. It looked like a powder keg. This looked like it could have gotten quite scary. Can you just describe for us what you witnessed?
Yeah, you know, I was there on Monday, and a totally different scene than Sunday was, and most of those videos that we saw circulating on social media. But it was kind of scary to a degree. Now, there was a lot more law enforcement there on Monday, and a lot less people. But it was just, you know, you're standing in the middle of Plain Street there, and on one side you have a protest going on. In their face are people shouting back at them, staring at them across the street, or people standing with very large guns. You just felt, I'm not trying to be overly dramatic here, but you felt that at any point, maybe this could have gone a very bad direction. Thankfully, it didn't on Monday compared to what we saw Sunday, with several protesters having signs ripped out of their hands and even people being assaulted.
Megan, you cover Bethel for the Claremont Sun, and I'm hoping that you can help set the scene as well. I understand that the village had received word that a small Black Lives Matter demonstration had been scheduled. Then that started to grow, and then word got out to people who might be opposed to such a demonstration, and things sort of snowballed from there. Can you help us understand?
Certainly, yes. I received a tip from a source in Bethel that a Black Lives Matter demonstration would be taking place on Sunday. And Alicia Gee, a native of Bethel and a current resident, organized the event. And in the days leading up to the demonstration, she worked with village administration to get the appropriate permits and worked with the police to develop a strategy for making sure that the area was safe. And I think as word spread throughout the village, it's a small town, and word does spread through small towns, as we all know, a counter demonstration began to develop. And when it came time on Sunday for the demonstration, which took place between 3 and 4, mobs of people, some described as members of motorcycle gangs, began to pour in. They actually stationed themselves in the area where the BLM demonstrators had originally planned to be. So the BLM demonstrators moved up the street. And over the course of the hour that the demonstration was set to last, there was a complete breakdown of law and order and a frightening display of violence and anger by the counter protesters. In the beginning, it was a more sort of calm and respectful interaction, with the BLM demonstrators standing on one side of the street and the counter protesters standing on the other. But before long, the counter demonstrators began to push their way through the BLM demonstrators' lines. And realizing that they had outnumbered the BLM demonstrators and the patrolling police officers, the police department had all 6 of their police officers on duty that day. The counter demonstrators began to overtly button the attendees, and verbal disagreements turned into heated arguments and then devolved into violence. The counter protesters would claim that all lives mattered and accused the BLM demonstrators of reverse racism. Racial slurs were screamed, and one after another, as you've seen in video clips, the peaceful protesters' signs were stolen and destroyed. And mind you, this is all while the counter protesters were carrying assault rifles and wielding baseball bats. So there was a sense of fear and intimidation purposefully directed at the BLM demonstrators. And it all sort of ended when a group of counter protesters put one BLM demonstrator in a headlock and dragged him to the ground. And then the Bethel Police Department deployed some tasers, but no one was struck, according to the police chief. But some people ran to the scene, others ran away from it, and ultimately the demonstration ended, and the BLM demonstrators were essentially run out of town by the counter demonstrators.
And we did see, Megan, an image, a viral video clip of a protester who, and he may have even been the one that you talked about being put in a headlock, because after that that scene that unfolded in the middle of a street. He was surrounded on the sidewalk in very close proximity to a Bethel police officer or perhaps a sheriff's deputy, somebody in law enforcement, when a counter-protester punched this man who your paper identified as Nicholas Reardon, punched in the back of the head. Are there any charges that have been filed following any of these incidents?
The latest information is that there is a charge and an arrest warrant out for that gentleman accused of that assault. The police are actively looking for that gentleman and plan to arrest him, and he is being charged.
And we're talking with Megan Alley of the Claremont Sun and Brad Underwood from Local 12 WKRC-TV. Brad, very strange messages coming from the Black Lives Matter demonstrators and supporters and the counter-protesters. Because if you watch the videos from the counter-protesters, you hear remarks like, go back to Cincinnati. These people came from out of town. These are outside agitators. But you even had village officials identify these bikers, these counter-protesters who were wielding very serious arsenal as out-of-town agitators. So was everyone involved here from out of town? What could you gauge from witnessing this up close?
It's a mix of both from what we were able to figure out. People involved in the Black Lives Matter protest, as Megan, mentioned, one of the organizers was a resident there. The young woman that we heard from at the top of the show, she's a resident of Bethel. She and her sisters were there. And then you did have people from Cincinnati. The gentleman who was hit, I don't know exactly where he lives, but he lives more closer to Cincinnati than he does Bethel. And then talking with a lot of the people on both sides on Monday, they admitted that they didn't recognize a lot of the faces on either group. The gentleman we heard from who said, they just don't want outsiders coming in, he didn't recognize a lot of the people that were shouting at the protesters next to him. So it was kind of a mix on both sides of people from Cincinnati. I met people from different parts of Claremont County that were there, not specifically Bethel. And I believe the gentleman who police are looking for, charging him with that misdemeanor assault, is from the Neville area, which is, give or take, maybe 20 miles from Bethel. So in both sides, it was a mix of people who lived there, people who maybe grew up there, moved away, and people who had maybe never been to Bethel until Sunday or Monday.
Megan, in our last few moments together, can you talk about this from a perspective of Bethel officials and residents? I'm sure this type of attention is mostly unwanted. And what type of community would they rather have people know about? What is Bethel typically like?
Bethel is working, has been working on developing sort of a brand for its village. People are very involved in politics there. Small town, big heart is their community brand, and I would agree that Bethel is a very community oriented town. They have a big nonprofit presence, local charities focused on helping low income families, focused on working with kids who might go underserved, school lunch programs, after school programs. They've had a school levy pass in December 2016, showing a lot of support for continued education resources for their local community. They did have a few years ago a bit of a back and forth politically with over an income tax intended to fund the local police department, and it was a several year ongoing saga with residents putting a referendum on the ballot in response to the village council passing the income tax without much consultation from the community. So they are a very active community, both politically and community-wise in terms of support. So this was unexpected in terms of what I've seen from that community. And I know that many of the leaders, many of the residents, seem to be very upset by the attention that this one particular event has brought upon the village. And I think that they're working to figure out how they can rectify that. And if this event has overturned a rock that needs to be managed in terms of bringing a community together that perhaps was divided, then they're going to work to do that.
Another curfew in effect in Bethel in anticipation, possibly, of more demonstrations. We'll keep our eye on that. Megan, excuse me, I knew I would do it at least once. Megan Alley from the Claremont Sun, thank you for your time. And WKRC-TV reporter Brad Underwood, thank you for being with us as well. We really appreciate you both sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much.
And this is Cincinnati on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Quote, our job is to lessen the odds of those tragedies occurring, and the steps that we're talking about today are steps that will truly make a difference. Those are the words from Governor Mike DeWine, who proposed changes to the law enforcement process as it relates to recruitment, training, and oversight. And joining us now to talk about it on the phone is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Andy, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So obviously, this is a response from the governor to the ongoing unrest, the protests as it relates to racism and violence at the hands of police towards the African-American community across the country. What are these plans that the governor rolled out?
So like you said, Michael, these are plans that have been sort of in the making for a couple of weeks now, ever since the death of George Floyd. Governor Mike DeWine went before his statewide briefing to say that something must be done. One of the first messages from those briefings was that he believed that it was an obligation of the public to make sure that police officers or to make sure that people who are racist are not police officers. Pretty strong language from the Republican governor there. So in the past couple of weeks, we know that the administration's been working on some type of proposals. And what we see here in these proposals and these reforms are things that sort of address the issue of bias, address or attempt to address the issue of racism at different entryways into the law enforcement system. So from when people are recruited, part of the proposal is to have mandatory psychological testing of the recruits. And then when it comes to training, more implicit bias training. And then on the other end of the spectrum, when there is an allegation of misconduct, stronger oversight, stronger accountability, and a board to oversee all of that.
Did the governor explain what the next steps are? This isn't something that he can implement by executive order, is it?
It is not. There are some things that he can implement on his own. There are things that the attorney general can do as well. But for most of these things, it has to be in partnership or through the passage of legislation from the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate. Now, the interesting thing there is, you know, there have been times where the governor's administration and the Ohio House, which is a Republican-controlled legislature, they've been at odds on certain pieces of legislation. But as far as we can see here, from what the governor proposed a couple of days ago, and from what House Republicans proposed last week, there are a lot of similarities, especially when it comes to more training and when it comes to broadening and strengthening the accountability side of things, creating an independent investigation unit. So this could be something where DeWine works pretty closely with the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate. The other part is that there's kind of a time crunch here. There's not a lot of scheduled meetings of the Ohio legislature over the next couple of months. This is typically the summer break.
And we're talking with Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. I note in your reporting, Andy, that the governor says chokeholds, which have been in the public conscience in recent months because of the ongoing civil unrest. He says that that should only be used if an officer believes he's in a life-threatening situation. And the life-threatening situation issue is often at the center of these conversations that we are forced to have after deadly violence involving a police officer and often an African-American person. So what has the response been to DeWine using that type of language in his remarks about chokeholds?
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing and from what we're hearing from a lot of anti-racism demonstrators is that they want this issue to be tackled head on, that this is clearly one of the biggest problems that you're hearing from protesters when it comes to the law enforcement system. When can police use the use of force? When can police use chokeholds? the argument has been that police feel that they are threatened, and that's why they do the things that they do in these questionable situations, in these situations where unarmed Black people end up dying because of this. And so House Minority Leader Amelia Sykes, the top House Democrat from Akron, she says that the term threat or life-threatening situation becomes subjective. And she says that, in her words, she says that Black bodies are viewed as weapons. And she uses different examples of when Black people have been harmed by officers, even though those Black victims were not armed.
And Andy, you said it looks like the governor will have to work with both chambers of the legislature to craft whatever legislation is to emerge officially from these recommendations. Did we get any indication from Minority Leader Sykes that she's willing to work with this?
You can definitely tell from Leader Amelia Sykes and from the Ohio Legislative Black Caucus that they want something to be done, and they want to work with whoever they can to get the ball moving. A fear that those leaders have expressed is that they believe that there's momentum here and they want to see the ball move forward. And they're afraid that, again, because the legislature is on somewhat of a break, that maybe this movement could lose momentum and then not see anything get done. But from what we are hearing from leaders from both sides of the aisle, is that they want to do something when it comes to police reforms. What the Democrats especially are calling for that they haven't seen yet, and what Leader Sykes says that she wants to see, is addressing what she calls the root of the problem, which is racism, addressing what she sees as racism being closely intertwined into the law enforcement system.
Andy, have we heard from police officers or the Fraternal Order of Police?
My colleague Karen Kassler, our State House Bureau Chief, was able to talk to FOP leaders. At this point, they're sort of watching and seeing what the exact proposals are going to be. I know that I've reached out to the FOP a couple of times. I've had sort of background conversations, but at this point, they haven't been wanting to talk very specifically about the details until they see more about what those proposals are looking like. But what we do know is that the FOP is very strong in the legislature. There's a very strong presence there as far as the sheriff's associations and other law enforcement groups. So what we do know is that they will be vocal in the process.
And your colleague, Karen Kassler, as you know, did report on this after speaking with the Ohio Fraternal Order of Police Vice President Jason Pappas. And he said, quote, "The public doesn't see how many officers are actually terminated from employment. All they see are the controversial ones." But he did also say, as far as what has been presented to us, there is very little that is going to cause us great concern. So, Andy, what happens next? Do we have any indication of what the next step might be?
I think at this point, it just sort of depends on what the Ohio House and what the Ohio Senate does. They could call leaders back into session to address the issue. They could wait until weeks from now when the next committee meetings are set to meet or when the next session is scheduled. So that will sort of be the next sort of sign to look for as how willing is the legislature to move this forward? Are they going to call a special session into order to move this legislation, or are they going to wait until scheduled sessions?
Andy Chow is a reporter with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Andy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And up next, we talk with Polly Campbell. She's the longtime food writer and critic at the Cincinnati Inquirer who announced her retirement. We're going to talk to her about her career and the food industry. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. After more than two decades of being the authority of the local food scene and the restaurant industry here in town, Polly Campbell is retiring as the Inquirer's food writer and critic. She joins us now on the phone. Polly, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations on your retirement. How do you feel today? Today's the day.
Today's my last day, yeah. I'm going through emails and, I don't know, trying to just stay busy.
Well, this is quite a run and quite a legacy you leave behind. And as I said, you've been the authority on food for some time, and you've covered all various aspects of the restaurant industry. Why now? Why is now the time to step away?
Oh, well, I don't know. It's just personal. It's partly health, you know, eating. I have for the last few years been hovering around the level of blood sugar that makes me diabetic, and I just really, really want to pay attention to myself and my health and find out what other things I can write about.
Well, we do wish you the best on that aspect. We did read that piece of information in John Kieswetter's story here at WVXU.org and in the column that you wrote last year about it. I want to talk about the restaurant business right now. You're leaving the business in a very strange time for the restaurant industry. They're facing this very challenging, unprecedented period that's not just an economic downturn. We've gone through those, but with this uncertainty surrounding not just a recovery, but this virus that's lingering. Just give us your perspective on what you're seeing all these people that you've covered for so long go through right now.
Yeah, and I do feel sort of strange to leave at this point. Because it'll be interesting to see, what happens. It's never going to be the same. And there's so many predictions about a lot of people closing, a lot of restaurants closing, and that wouldn't surprise me at all. And it's going to be a slightly different world, even if this ever ends. people may have gotten used to doing carryout or delivery. Their habits may have changed. They may just never want to go back to eating in a place with other people nearby.
And we're talking with Polly Campbell. She is the food writer and critic at the Cincinnati Inquirer. Today is her last day as she sets off to retire. And Polly, you've had a lot of meals over the years in Cincinnati, and the restaurant scene here has evolved so dramatically in the period of time that you've been here. I mean, I think back to the late 90s, mid-90s, and we were all still talking about, you know, the Maisonette and how proud the city was to have this five-star restaurant here in town. And I mean, that's long gone now, but there's like a whole different reason to care about food here. Can you talk a little bit about that experience from going from what the city's food scene was like, what mattered when you started, to what you're watching now?
Yeah. Oh, it is just a dramatic difference. And it's been so much fun to be in on it all. I think when I first started, like you said, Maisonette, there had been these five-star restaurants in Cincinnati. We could go out to eat to a fine restaurant. That was not a problem, you know. And then if we just wanted to go out in the middle of the week, you know, it was something kind of family-oriented, nothing really special, maybe a sort of generic Chinese restaurant or something like that. And then as people really just got so involved in food, just as a national trend, you know, it was more important to everybody to eat well all the time, you know. So now you go to the zoo and you get good food. You go to the Reds game, you don't just get hot dogs, you get these fancy burgers and things. It's just more of an expectation for things to be good, to be maybe, you know, homemade or made there, wherever you're eating, and to eat out more often and to eat well no matter what price point you're at. So many more ethnic restaurants and good bar food and, you know, just whatever you can name is just way better than it used to be.
Certainly. And, Polly, as you reflect on the change in the restaurant industry, you've obviously also been a direct part of the change in the journalism industry. And a lot of journalists, even at the Inquirer, have seen their positions eliminated in recent years. All media outlets have experienced this to some degree. Mm-hmm. But the food beat has remained, which shows the significance and the importance of that. And according to John Kieswetter here at WVXU, we talked to Burl Love, the executive editor at the Inquirer. They're going to hire another one to do what you do. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the business of food journalism at the local level and why so many find it to be important.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of amazing that I somehow made it through all of this. And it wasn't me, it was my beat, you know. But it's so much a part of it's what we call a passion topic. You know, people love to talk about food. You often get in these restaurant conversations at parties and stuff. You know, people are proud of the restaurants in their neighborhood, and they're being used to help neighborhoods really develop. People just feel so strongly about it, and it's not something that you can get some kind of syndicated content about. I mean, a local person has to write it. And, you know, chefs have become celebrities, and it's just part of the vitality of the city. And by covering it, it's being part of that, positive force in the city and telling people things that they want to know, like where they should go to eat tonight.
And you also went through a change in your personal branding in the Enquirer. And the Enquirer has been sharing some of your highlights over the years. And one of them that I think probably was very popular was your explanation of, quote, why I'm losing the hat. And that's a reference to how you were presented as an image in the print edition of the paper. And on the digital side, was you were wearing a hat because your identity was partially concealed, certainly early on. Tell us a little bit about that evolution from trying to keep some semblance of anonymity so that you could be more of a surprise to the restaurants that you were reviewing to just being open about who you are.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's it's an inherited idea when I started, the idea that you wanted to write a review of a restaurant that where you weren't treated any differently than somebody else who would walk in. So you didn't want them to know who you are, which was very logical, and in a lot of ways it'd be great if you could still do that. But I tried it for a while. It was always kind of fun. It was this cat and mouse game, you know, and I had credit cards in different names and stuff, and it was fun. Everybody would say, now, do you wear your hat when you go out? I'm like, no, that's not how it works. I don't wear the hat when I go out. I just wear the hat in my photo. But after some time, I started feeling like I was kind of faking. I was kind of lying, you know, because a lot of people had figured out who I was. And I wasn't actually that anonymous anymore, just because, you know, it's a smallish city, and I got around. And I didn't want to have to not go talk to people to write stories just to keep my anonymity. So, you know, I was covering a beat, and as time went on, I wrote more and more sort of feature stories. So and many other critics in other cities had done the same thing. And so I just sort of made a deal out of it to kind of... It wasn't the kind of reviewing that I cared about. I wasn't going in and like ticking off, you know, 3 points for that, 10 points for this. It's more of the way I like to review a restaurant is much more of a sort of gestalt, you know. It's like, how do the servers make you feel? How do they seem to be trained? You know, things that wouldn't matter that much how anonymous I was.
And we're talking with Polly Campbell, the longtime food writer and critic at the Cincinnati Enquirer. Today is her last day as she is retiring to explore other opportunities. I think my favorite revisiting of an article you wrote that the Enquirer has republished online was your trip to the Olive Garden that you wrote about last year. The headline, after 23 years as a food critic, she finally went to Olive Garden. And I mean, you ultimately conclude that you would recommend smaller locally owned restaurants here that are of the Italian variety. I'm wondering, in your position and really with the power that you wield and the influence that you wield in the position that you hold, how did you go about choosing which places you should be highlighting or visiting and critiquing?
Well, and that was not that hard to start with for many years. You know, their restaurants didn't open at any kind of breakneck pace. If there was a new restaurant anywhere in our, well, almost any restaurant anywhere in our 7-county coverage area, you know, I'd go try it out. I mean, it'd have to be a restaurant of some seriousness, you know, a place that has full service and so on. And that, it was not easy. It was not that hard to keep up. In fact, I often went back and re-reviewed restaurants on weeks there wasn't a new one to do. Well, things really sped up, and it got to be kind of difficult to decide. In the last 4 or 5 years or so, you know, some place would open, but they didn't, like, they didn't take reservations. And I thought, well, you know, or they didn't have service. It was a counter service place, but the food was really good. Or, you know, the kind of restaurant where you could get good food that was reviewable really opened up. There were all kinds of different food. And it was, or it would be a food restaurant that only served one thing, you know. And so it got a little difficult to decide. Like, this, I sort of had this idea in my head of a reviewable restaurant being something with full service and a wine list, you know. So I had to kind of changed my mind on that. But towards the end there, I didn't have time to go to all the restaurants. So I went to the ones that sounded the most interesting to me, I guess.
Did you ever write a review that you ended up regretting upon a second visit?
No. Mm-mm. I mean, you know, restaurants maybe can change. But, you know, actually, I don't really get back to restaurants that often.
Yeah, sure.
So, but, no.
Well, what about...
Bad about.
Let's just say, did you receive any interesting or nasty responses? Not necessarily from fans. We know that's easy from readers to leave nasty comments. But, I mean, anybody in the industry who... And you don't have to identify anybody, of course.
No,
but,
no.
I mean, what type of messages did you get if maybe you weren't too favorable to something?
You know, I don't know what to attribute this to. Whether it's that I am really not harsh in how I say things, or it's that people are scared of me, were scared of me. Now they won't be scared of me anymore. I did not get a lot of people calling back and yelling at me. And just a few times, sure, but not really. And I've told this story before, but early on, I had written a review of a restaurant, and I was trying to be funny, you know. And I went in this riff that didn't have anything to do with the restaurant itself, really. It was just kind of a thing. And then I didn't really like the restaurant very much, and I said that. And the owner called me, and he's like, you know, I took out a second mortgage on my house to open this restaurant. And, you know, what am I supposed to do? And I'm like, that made me think less about, you know, whether I should be honest and say what I thought, but more about the tone in which I did it and take each restaurant seriously and take each restaurant kind of, the question is, does it do what it's setting out to do, you know? And to some extent, is that a worthwhile thing to do? But, you know, you don't review a cheap restaurant, same as an expensive restaurant, et cetera. So.
We're talking with Polly Campbell, the retiring Cincinnati Inquirer food writer and critic. Today is her last day. I want to ask before we go, over the years, we have seen a lot of great restaurants come and go. We already referenced the Maisonette. I'm wondering if any one or two stands out as one that you miss.
Yeah. This is funny. I was just thinking about this the other day. One of the restaurants that I think I really would love to have stayed was a small chain that Paul Sturkey started called Encore. They were suburban, but they were really, as I recall, the food was quite sophisticated. It was really nice atmosphere, and it just kind of, it fit into a niche that wasn't otherwise covered somehow, you know. That's one that popped in my head the other day. There's a lot of other ones that are gone, and I feel sorry, but that's one that definitely, I was sorry didn't work out.
And what was the biggest surprise for you, do you think, over the years, where maybe you didn't expect to enjoy an experience as much as you did?
Oh, you know, one that was fun that way was, I don't remember how long ago this was. Who knows? But I just heard of a new restaurant called Nouveau, and it was out in, like, Burlington or Florence or Erlang or one of those places. Sorry, I get my northern community.
I live over there, and I understand.
Sorry. Anyway, it was in an old Pizza Hut, and I saw, and it was you can always tell an old Pizza Hut by the shape of the windows, you know. And I thought, I don't know, a little weird. it was Mark Bodenstein's first restaurant, and I still remember this wonderful dish of pork with beet puree or something. Anyway, that was so much fun to have that turn out to be so good.
I love that. Polly Campbell, good luck to you. Congratulations on your retirement from The Inquirer. We'll look forward to seeing what happens next for you.
Yeah, okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. And you can find our archives online. Listen to any show from the past anytime you want at WVXU.org. We're back on Monday. Have a great weekend. I'm Michael Monks.